Good evening and welcome back to Ulcerative Colitis Motherhood and Me. I'm Ulcerative Colitis Mama, and first of all, can I just apologise for once again having quite a long absence between my podcasting content. I was originally going to start posting something on Tuesday, and I had a few sort of things that I wanted to sort of discuss, but when I played back the content, I wasn't happy with it, and it just sort of didn't flow, and anyway, I sort of kind of scrapped that draft. So, and then as sort of the week got on, unfortunately, I came down with a bit of a cold and poor sinuses. So I do sound a little bit probably nasally tonight. So it is still me. I just sound very, very different. So tonight's episode, I wanted to kind of focus a little bit more on the mental health side of things, particularly with myself at the moment. I know a lot of my content does discuss mental health, mental well-being, because I think out of the sort of the three main aspects of my social platforms and things like that is mental health, because it just seems to feed into so much more, just feeds into every aspect of our lives, really. Our health, our relationships, our, you know, sort of our social interactions with other people, our work, family, everything. It just sort of gets guided by how sort of how your mental health sort of plays out, really. So when it's good, it's great, and when it's not so good, it's not so good. So I just wanted to talk about kind of what's going on with me at the moment, kind of more as an outlet, really, because I feel like I'm kind of letting things stack up again and bottling things up again. So just to add a trigger warning in before I go on to this episode, like I said, I do discuss a lot of mental health topics in my content, and I do appreciate people at various stages of their recovery, and some of the stuff I might discuss might be quite triggering for some people. So as always, listener discretion is advised. I do talk about things like anxiety, depression. I do discuss things about sort of suicide and sort of a lot of things that kind of can be quite sensitive subjects to some listeners. So without further ado, let's get started into tonight's episode. Okay, so just a quick heads up. I have little G roaming around upstairs, still awake. So I am listening out for him to make sure he doesn't decide to sneak downstairs and interrupt my content. Also, as you can tell, I've just had a full-blown coughing fit, so I am okay. But if I have to kind of stop start a lot of the recording tonight, and it does seem a little bit jittery, and that's probably because I'm either chasing my son back upstairs, or I've developed another massive coughing fit, but I'm okay. I'm still with you. So yeah, going into tonight's episode then, as most of my listeners are probably aware, probably the biggest subject that I do discuss on my platforms is mental health and well-being. And that's probably because it has the greatest impact on my life as a whole. And I think, you know, it can be said, it can be all around, really, because it's not just how you feel, it's just how it kind of affects things like your work, your family, your social interactions or lack thereof, your health. Mental health has a very, very big role in that. And at the moment, while the colitis is actually behaving itself and probably being one of the only sort of aspects of my life that's actually under control and stable, every cloud has a silver lining, as they say. But I've been very aware the last few weeks that my mental health hasn't been great. I'm okay. Please don't worry. I'm absolutely fine. I'm still functioning and things like that, but I am very aware that it's not as, the seas aren't as calm as they normally are. And I think there's just a lot going on at the moment in terms of work, family, and obviously this this time of year as well. It's approaching, well, in fact, it's just been a little over 12 months since my friend Ethan passed away suddenly last year. And for those, I'll keep it brief because I do feel a little bit guilty discussing Ethan, as a, you know, obviously he's not here to consent to any of the information I divulge. But basically, I had a friend called Ethan who kind of I knew him through friends. He was a friend of a friend that kind of hung around in the same large group of guys that I used to go out sort of drinking with in my younger days, pre little G days, you know, sort of back, you know, looking sort of 10, coming up to 11 years ago. And he was quite a shy sort of kind of guy, didn't really have that many conversations with him. And when I started blogging, of quite a few years ago, and I was looking into branching out into podcasting and things, and I was going through a bit of a tough time, and particularly in the first couple of years of my mental health struggles, I really struggled to find somebody to reach out to. And this is why I find the podcasting like a real help for me, because it's my way of kind of getting, you know, my thoughts and feelings out there without feeling like I'm burdening anybody. And it's, even if nobody listens to my content, I feel like it's almost like journalizing it and kind of letting it go and releasing those feelings and emotions. And basically, harking back a few years now, I stumbled across a blog, and it was a mental health blog, and I found it on one of the social media platforms, and it just kind of sort of felt quite familiar, some of the, you know, and I recognized the name, and I thought, is it the same guy, is it the same Ethan that used to hang around with, you know, X, Y, and Z back in 2012? Anyway, I did a little bit of research, and I found his blog, or a branch of his blog, on one of his more accessible social media sites. And I dropped him a message and just said, look, you know, I've read your content, I can relate. He'd gone through a really, really tough time, and he was sort of building his way back up, and, you know, sort of again sharing his journey, his recovery, and that how it, and he was very honest and open that it wasn't a linear journey. He was having, you know, bumps along the way, and he was having tough days, but then he'd have good days too. And, you know, we exchanged a few messages, and I just said, look, you know, I'm, you know, I'm here if you want to talk, and vice versa. And he was a very good go-to person at the time. Even though we didn't know each other that well, it was, we kind of bonded over our own sort of respective journeys. And then I found out sort of last January that he'd passed away very suddenly. And although I'm not 100% sure to this day, the actual cause of his passing, the arrows were very much pointing towards the, you know, that he'd taken his own life. And it was absolutely horrific and very upsetting. It was, he was 31. And I really, really struggle with it, because it just, he had a lot to give to this world, and him sharing his thoughts and feelings probably helped many, many people. Myself being one of them. And it was incredibly sad. And I attended his funeral, which was just heartbreaking. And like I said, I try not to talk about him too much, because he's not here to kind of consent to anything I discuss about him. But basically, it's been just over 12 months since he passed. So that's very much played on my mind, however sort of much in the forefront, it's lingered there. The other sort of big sort of event that occurred last year as well was, which is almost coming up to the first anniversary, is obviously the passing of my biological father, which came as a massive shock. And again, it was one of those that I'd found out from a third party, not directly from any family. So again, I've got pretty much a full blog post and podcast episode regarding that, and I'm still dealing with that, I think. And like I said previously, and I've probably said it many, many times in other posts, is that I had the distraction of the wedding last year to kind of keep things at bay. And I think now I've got no obvious distractions at the moment. Things are starting to creep back a little bit, and I think I am aware of that, and I'm not dealing with it probably head on. I'm kind of still very much denying it and not letting it pass, really. And I think because of the nature of how I found out and the lack of closure that I've had, I find it very hard to move on. So with all that going on, plus the fact, which, you know, and I mentioned a lot of this content in my previous episode, I've had a lot going on in terms of I'm awaiting gynae surgery, although it being relatively minor. I have to go for a general anaesthetic next month, which I'm quite nervous about, to say the least. Plus the fact I've got to travel again, that 100-mile round trip to get that sorted. And so that's kind of obviously bothering me at the moment. It's being a distraction, but not in a good way. I was also involved in a road traffic collision on Christmas Day, which I really, really didn't need, which resulted in my car unfortunately being written off. And I was very sad about that, really, because although it wasn't the most amazing car in the world, it was my car and I loved it. So the stress of then sourcing a new vehicle, because obviously being a community nurse, I need a car to work and just to generally get around every day. The current state of things in this country, and this is how, you know, obviously the two things I will never discuss on any of my social platforms, and that's politics and religion. But just to kind of give you a bit of an insight, the country is in probably dire straits, shall we say. And so obviously inflation and everything has crept up, which means basically now the cost of used cars is now probably twice that of what it was about 4 years ago when I actually purchased my last car. So I did get a very generous payout from my insurer, or from the third party's insurer, I should say, which I was very surprised to get, but it didn't actually cover, it probably covered just under half of a semi-decent vehicle that was, you know, lowish mileage, less than 10 years old, and hadn't been absolutely trashed by its previous owners. So I saw a car, it wasn't my first choice. It means to an end. It's a machine to get you from A to B and back to A again. And it was, you know, kind of ticked all the boxes in terms of, you know, I don't want a sport, you know, sporty, shiny, lovely car. I just want a safe vehicle that isn't going to cost me the earth, you know, in repairs and wear and tear. So I thought, great, I can put the money from my insurer or from the insurance down as a deposit. And then what I'll do is I'll borrow the rest from the bank. I already have a loan out with the bank to pay off my old car, which doesn't get paid off till sort of spring next year. So I thought, no, it's fine. A lot of banks offer you like a top up, so you can basically borrow a little bit more on top of the existing loan. So you still have to pay obviously that loan back, but you get a little bit more, and obviously the terms change and everything. So anyway, I found the car, ordered the car, went to, you know, apply for the top up loan through the bank, and it got rejected. So that was a bit of a spanner in the works, shall we say, and it was quite upsetting. So then I spent about 45 minutes on the phone to my bank, basically asking why. And they said, oh, we won't know until at least 24 hours after the application. It doesn't give us, you know, a reason why, because it doesn't actually say when your application gets rejected. And I said, but I need them. I need the money. I need, you know, I'm trying to purchase a vehicle, which I need for my job, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, in fairness to the call handler, she was very, very good. And, you know, basically it was something to do with my credit score. My credit score is absolute crap. So, which basically means if you're, you know, I don't have any credit cards, store cards, anything like that. The only debts I've had have been my mortgage and my previous car loans. So I've not really dipped into debt or anything. So as a consequence, my credit score is absolutely crap. So, and that was their reasoning for rejecting my application. So then I'm sat there thinking, I'm going to have to cancel this car order now. I'm going to look like an idiot. That was probably the best quality car I'd seen in the however many 20, 30 cars that I'd been to see in the space of that week. I was exhausted. I was just fed up. The thing is, there was no making the comparison to my old car. There was no real comparison, and there's no models of that car for sale at the moment within my price range. So I kind of found something similar, albeit smaller, but found something similar. So in fairness to the garage, I appreciate they've got to make a sale. They did say, look, please don't be upset. Why don't we discuss finance options? And if it's really not what you want to go for, or it's, you know, it's not an option, then you can walk away and, you know, that's it. But at least you'll know you've looked into it. So anyway, I went back to the garage, sat down, went through the finance options, and I got accepted straight away. It does mean now that I'm in even more debt than I was before. So it means not only am I paying off a loan, I'm also paying off a finance, which is quite a bit of money. And I'm going to be paying off quite a bit of money for the next 4 years, possibly two if I trade in early, but I'm lumbered with it now. So that has caused me a lot of stress. And I know there's thousands of people across the country that buy things on finance every single day. And it's probably the same thing as everything else on hire purchase. If you pay your bill, there's not an issue. But I think because I've never done it before, it was a completely alien concept to me. Then I started panicking, thinking I'm going to get things repossessed. I'm not going to afford anything. I'm going to not have any money. I'm going to, you know, I started catastrophizing before like anything actually happened. And that's it. I can't buy anything now. I'm going to have to be really, really frugal with my money. I'm going to have to be really careful and just kind of just be more sensible, blah, blah, blah. And I sat there for a good 2 days after I'd ordered the car in complete panic, worrying about my finances now, which is something I've never really worried about before. I've always been very sensible with my money, apparently too sensible. That's why my credit score's so crap. So anyway, I've got the car now, it's running fine, but then it's like, oh, the price of fuel and everything like that. So it has been like one stress after another, and I'm just starting to kind of calm down a little bit now. In terms of the car anyway. And what I've done is I've picked up some overtime over the next few months with work, which will kind of put my mind at rest in terms of finances, because then if I do so many overtimes a month, that will actually pay off my, you know, that'll cover the costs of my new car. So I need to calm down a little bit. that's kind of basically what people keep telling me. I just need to chill out, which, you know, for somebody with severe anxiety, we'd love to be able to chill out, wouldn't we? But no, we don't. And this is what we struggle with. So that's kind of been bothering me at the moment. But as I'm getting used to the new car, you know, kind of still mourning for my old one, but I'm getting used to it and I'm kind of getting a bit braver and driving a little bit further with it each time now. And so it's a little bit of normality returning slowly. Then last week, it kind of dawned on me that Big G was planning to go on a climbing trip to Scotland. He does at least once a year, goes up to the Cairngorms in Scotland. So that's right at the very north corner of Scotland, because it's the best conditions for people like him that like ice climbing and general kind of dangerous hobbies, which is fine. And I'm normally okay with it. I worry, but like to a reasonable level. However, this year he's not gone with his usual friends. So what's happened is he's kind of got in touch with people from like mountaineering group. So they're obviously like, you know, experienced mountaineers, people that have, you know, but they're, it's a complete stranger he's gone with. So what's happened is I think he's done a little bit of like networking with these sort of climbing groups. And somebody said, well, I'm heading up that weekend. Do you want to jump in with me and just cover fuel? Great. Sensible. Economic. Safe, because there's two of them. And he's staying up in the one of the, what they call the CIC huts in the Cairngorms, which is like basically a hut. Well, it's a kind of like a hostel that's not manned, as far as I gather. So thankfully I've had confirmation that he's arrived and he's in the hut, so he's safe. But there's always this worry in the back of my mind because of the nature of the, you know, the sport, the thing that he does, it does come with risks. And as experienced as he is, the risk is always there. And I worry because he's, you know, hundreds of miles away from home, on his own effectively, and with people he doesn't know, and, you know, that he's going out and doing this crazy stuff. And I, you know, I don't hear from him as much because obviously if he's staying in a hut in the middle of the Cairngorms, he's not going to have great phone signal. Nevertheless, he's probably not going to have much electricity either. So I'm kind of living on pins at the minute. It also means I'm at home alone with the child and the dog, which is fine, which, you know, I'm kind of used to. You know, it's, you know, he's been away on business trips. He's been away on climbing trips before. For some reason, I feel like I'm less settled about this one. And it probably is because he's gone there with people he doesn't know. So I in a way, I feel like, are they going to be as, you know, are they going to look after him as well as his friends would? He's, you know, he's a 36-year-old man. He can look after himself. It's just, you know, he's the love of my life and, you know, my husband. So I want to make sure he's okay. So, you know, I'm just thankful I've heard from him today on, you know, sort of relatively regular intervals, you know, where he is and landmarks and various other things. It's just a little bit harder to kind of figure out where he is and what he's doing and if he's okay. Apologies. I'm, as you can tell, some of the content has been split into little segments, so it's probably going to be a little bit jittery, and that's mainly because I'm having coughing fit every 10 minutes and I'm getting a bit more croaky. I got hit with this really bad sinus kind of head cold, so I've been off sick for the back end of last week, and again I've been feeling incredibly guilty about that because I never go off sick. The last time I went off sick was when I had my car accident, and that was mainly probably because of the more of the kind of the shock and the distress over the fact that I'd hurt my shoulder, and probably because of the time of year in which it happened. So I do, I never go off sick. The last time I went off sick was back end of 2020, if you're not counting the times I've had to self-isolate because of COVID. Otherwise, I've not been off sick. So, you know, I really, really struggled back end of last week. And as you can say, I'm still a bit sort of croaky at times. I'm still sort of coughing, but my head doesn't feel like it's about to burst, which is great. You know, it's everything, you know, it's kind of on the looking a bit more positive at the moment. So yeah, I've had a lot of kind of like stresses, and you know, it doesn't take the brains of an archbishop to figure out that, you know, I kind of, my anxiety has been really kind of on high alert for the last couple of weeks. And I think, you know, like I said, I'm used to being at home on my own with the child and the fur child, and it, you know, it's a non-issue. It's not an issue at all. But it's also the school holidays. And so, you know, childcare's a little bit of a juggling act at the best of times. So obviously little G's going to have to kind of go between my mum and me in-laws and, you know, and nipping back in two, which is fine. It's just a bit of hassle. But I think because I'm an anxious person, a little bit of hassle to a non-anxious person is quite a bit of stress to an anxious person. And it's just how I deal with stuff. And I deal with it. I worry like hell about it, but I deal with it and I get through it and I move on. But I think I just feel quite isolated. And I know I'm not, because I've got a really good network. I've got my family close by. I've got, you know, my in-laws live down the road, literally down the road. My mum and stepdad live, you know, 10 miles down the road. I've got a good network of friends that are always at the end of the phone if I just need somebody to talk to. My colleagues are absolutely amazing and very understanding, because they're like normal people. But I think because I've been off sick from work, I've not had any social interaction at all. I kind of been very much like a hermit for the last few days. That kind of plays on my mind as well. I normally don't mind my own company. Always have done. I've always been not a loner. That sounds a bit whatever, but I've never really minded. I've always found stuff to do. I've always found it in a way. Yeah, it's sometimes okay to have your own company. Just stick, you know, a box set on and just kind of chill with the dog. But I think I'm worrying about Big G. And he's just so far away. It's not like he's just, you know, on a night shift or whatever, where he's, again, 10, 11 miles down the road. He's, you know, about 400-500 miles away, and with limited access to electricity and phone signal and everything. So that's playing on my mind, and I can't wait for Thursday. I really can't wait for him to come home. And I think I do depend on him quite a lot. And I think I don't mean that in terms of like I don't let him go anywhere. It's just I like the reassurance knowing that he's not far away, and he kind of gets it. Well, obviously we've been together almost 20 years, and you know, he's been there at my very worst, lowest points in my life. You know, I sometimes, him just being nearby is more than enough reassurance. And I think the last sort of few months, maybe more so the last few weeks, my confidence has hit an all-time low, and I don't really know why. And it's my confidence in everything, decision making, whether that's personal, professional life, just generally my own ability to get through the day, I don't feel confident for. And I'm laughing about it, but in all seriousness, I do feel like I'm second guessing every single thing I do, every decision I make, everything, however small it might be. You know, and I'm getting very irritable with it as well. And I know that's a big part of my anxiety, that I do get irritable and I do tend to then get short-tempered and lose my temper. And it's generally with the people I'm closest to. And unfortunately, when Big G's not here, unfortunately, it's little G and the dog that cop it. And it, you know, and I know it's most parents do lose their rag now and again. And, you know, and it is what it is. But the immense guilt I've felt for the last couple of days is rocked me completely. I feel like the worst parent in the world at the moment, because I just tend to nag or shout or, you know, threaten to confiscate things. And, you know, and it, in a sense, it's probably a control thing. And I never wanted to be a controlling person or parent. And I think the more anxious I get, the more controlling I try and take back control. And it kind of conflicts, because a lot of things that I'm anxious about, I have no control over. And because I don't have control over them, I get anxious. And it is just that kind of catch 22 situation all the time. And I really, really struggle with that, particularly at the moment. And because I'm one of these people that don't like to, you know, this is probably one of the main reasons that I podcast as well. I don't like to feel like I'm burdening people. And then when I do, I feel guilty, because it's like, oh, here she goes again. She's miserable again, and she can't cope again, and she's tearful again, and she's naggy again. I feel like people are going to start losing patience with me. So I keep it bottled up and bottle it up and bottle it up, and eventually I snap. And this happens quite often in work, because the people I work with probably spend more time with me than anybody else does. And they see changes in my behavior, in my mood. And quite often they'll ask if I'm okay. And because I don't want to, again, burden them with my issues, my problems, my anxieties, I'll tell them I'm okay. I'm fine. We all know that fine doesn't actually mean fine, don't we? It's a complete subtext. It's a complete kind of juxtaposition right there. But I kind of hit a low before Christmas, sort of probably beginning of December. I felt pretty low in myself, to the point where I didn't want to go to my Christmas party, because I thought, no, I'm just going to spread my misery around and suck the life out of everybody. And to be fair, I kind of put my big girl pants on and I did go, and I enjoyed myself. I did kind of feel really, really anxious while I was there, but I did overall, I don't regret going. And I was supposed to go to a meal out the sort of the Friday that I tried to, I'm stressed about the calf situation. And because I got myself that beaten up over it and that worked up, and that I was pretty hysterical, to be fair, which I know was completely disproportionate to the actual issue, because it got resolved quite quickly. You know, just get it on finance, fine, pay X amount a month for 100 years and try not to starve yourself. But it was resolved within that day. Yeah, I still carried this kind of adrenaline and sort of hyper kind of irrationality for the rest of the day, to the point where I thought, I can't go out like this. I can't go out like this. Notwithstanding the fact that the car that I was borrowing off Big G, the battery kept going flat, and I thought, I could probably get there, but I won't be able to get back. So it was, I just ended up just bowing out at last minute. And then again, I felt guilty, because my work bestie had spent, she's the chief organizer of everything. And she'd spent days, weeks organizing this meal, making sure everybody could attend, making sure that everybody was catered for. And I just go off and just don't turn up. I did text her, I did message her and explain, but I still feel really guilty about that, to the point where I kind of getting a little bit like, oh, maybe they don't really like me anymore. This is what I do. I end up punishing myself by punishing myself, if that makes sense, that I kind of already feel bad and I kick myself when I'm down. And case in point, with me being off sick this week, now in normal circumstances, you know, obviously, like, you know, everything's been a little bit off with, you know, short staffing and everything like that. Normally when you go off sick and you phone it in and sort of report that you're off sick and you self-certify and everything like that, you normally get a phone call from a senior member of staff just to check up to see, you know, have you got a, you know, rough day you think you'll be back in, and things like kind of like a check-in. And I appreciate, obviously, I've added to the short staffing issue and rationally speaking, they've probably not had time to do that because they've had to pull in all you know, available staff to cover my absence. And obviously the workload increases when we lose a member of staff. So, but then my more dominant irrational brain is thinking, you've pissed them off now, they don't care. And I will find out tomorrow when I go back to work which side of the coin it is. So I've just kept doing my side of the deal where I phone them to let them know if I'm still off, and then I phone them to tell them I'm, and each time it's gone to voicemail, which in a way is kind of good for me because in my personal capacity, I hate being on the phone. I hate, even if it's somebody I know, I don't like being on the phone, or I don't like people phoning me. I get tremendously anxious. Whereas if I'm in work, I'm fine. I can phone anyone. You ask me to phone literally anybody and I will, in work, because I'm there in a different capacity. I'm a different person when I'm in work. I'm a little bit more confident generally. But even then, I'm not. At the moment, last few months, I've kind of second-guessed everything and kind of looked to senior colleagues for their confirmation and reassurance, because I don't feel that I've made the right decision. And I did have a kind of like a serious incident at work where, I mean, there was no fault of anything. I may have even discussed it on previous episodes. I don't play them back, so I forget what content I've actually delivered. And I don't like hearing the sound of my own voice, believe it or not. And basically, there was a serious incident that occurred at work, which had a bit of a detrimental effect on me, because I know in my professional capacity, I did everything and probably even a bit more than what was expected of me within work. But I still carry a lot of guilt and worry about it. Apologies, I had another coughing fit. So since then, I think it's knocked my confidence. It was basically the first weekend I came back after my almost 3 weeks off work following my wedding. And it was very much being thrown into the deep end, and it was a horrible incident, and it's really, really upsetting. And even though I've had I've spoken to my senior manager and my senior manager who oversaw the serious incident review, and she actually praised myself and my colleague who were involved in that particular incident and said, you know, you were phenomenal and you've basically gone above and beyond what was expected of you. And yeah, I still torture myself about it, to the point where I thought, I don't think I'm cut out to be a nurse anymore. I'm losing confidence in my own abilities. And I discussed this with my senior manager. We had like a one-to-one meeting a few weeks back. And, you know, she even reassured me, you know, you gave 120%. Both you and your colleague gave 120% that evening, and nobody thinks any worse of you. And following that discussion, she referred me on to occupational health, which I think was a very sensible decision and probably not one I would have reached myself without a little bit of encouragement. So I had a telephone consultation with a nurse or a doctor. I can't remember what she said, from occupational health on Friday. And I went through, gave him a bit of a brief synopsis of what happened, on that particular incident and how it's had an impact. And I did sort of go on to elaborate that I've had other personal issues that have probably had an effect on my well-being and a few other things going on. And she then said, I think you need to go to counselling. Excuse me. And I agreed. So I referred myself to the, basically my health board have a kind of like a contract with a third party service that offer counselling services. So I had to kind of phone the main occupational health department, who were very, very lovely, by the way, who then gave me the phone number for the counselling service. So I had to then, I left a voicemail, I think, and I did like an online form to, you know, so I'll probably get a phone call tomorrow from them just to organise when I can go and see them or speak to them or whatever. I know it can only do good. I've had talking therapy a lot. Oh, probably in the last 10 years, I've had it quite a lot. And I've had it at least twice through work. And I think because it's a hard job. It's a really hard job. And even if you're in a relatively low risk kind of area, things are going to creep up on you from time to time. And we're human. And, you know, I'm quite hard on myself anyway, because I look around me and I don't see people react the way I do. But then I can't read people's minds. I know that. And people react to things in different ways. People have had different experiences outside of their work role, or people have had a lot of experience and they're not desensitized to it, but they approach it from a different perspective, or they're very much in the swan kind of looking graceful but paddling like hell under the surface of the water. And I know I've reached a kind of a point in my life at the moment where I do need to speak to somebody. And this counselling can only do some good, right? So I will try my utmost and try and, you know, because I think unfortunately we only get something like 4 sessions. It might have changed, but I know last time I had counselling, I was only entitled to 4 sessions from work, because that's all they could fund. So I had to cram a lot of stuff into those four hours, or 4 sets of 45 minutes, whatever. So I may have to do that again. And when I spoke to occupational health, they did sort of say, look, you know, we'll try you out with talking therapies and counselling, just see how you go. But if, you know, it kind of doesn't work, or we're going to have to refer you back to your GP, which probably means I'm going to have to go back to community mental health services if, worst case scenario, basically, which, again, isn't a bad thing. It's not, because I've got to give myself a little bit of credit for that. I've I got discharged from community mental health services 4 years ago, almost to the month. It was the beginning of 2019 that I got discharged. And I was very much on a high then. I was in a really good place. And I've got to appreciate life takes a bit of a turn sometimes. It's like I said, recovery is not linear. And, you know, and I appreciate that. And I also appreciate I've had a lot of stuff happen, particularly in the last 12 months. So that's not going to pass me by without any effect on me. And I know myself that perhaps the way that I've responded to the loss of my dad in particular is not the standard way of grieving, because I've had no closure from it. With the loss of Ethan, I was able to kind of grieve properly, and I'm using that in inverted commas, because I had the shock, the sadness, the upset, and I've able to kind of, although it's going to hurt me for, you know, and it's always going to be a sad memory, an incredibly sad memory, and you know, it is going to have an effect on me for the rest of my life. I was able to grieve properly for Ethan because I was able to be upset and go to his funeral and say what I needed to say to him and say my goodbyes and my thank yous and be around other people that also loved him and cared about him and shared stories and remembered him that way and honoured him that way, which kind of is the kind of the general pattern when it comes to grief and loss. With my dad, however, it was very different because not only was I not told that he was ill, I wasn't told that he died. I wasn't informed by any member of the family, and it's how I'm trying to deal with the information or lack thereof that I've been given. And the way it was delivered, and bearing in mind, for those of you who don't know, I reached out to an auntie and two of my uncles, which it's not that difficult to find people's addresses if you Google them, or other search engines are just as useful. But I was able to find their addresses. So I thought, well, if it's that easy, then surely it would be just as easy to find out where I was. Bearing in mind, one of my uncles is actually a retired detective. So there's a bit of irony there, isn't it? So anyway, I reached out to him because out of all of them, I felt he was the more down to earth, more kind of, with him being a retired police officer, I thought it's very much, you know, he'd be the more personable one that would see the logic. And the letter I got from him was, well, it was not very well worded, considering his, you know, kind of professional background, but it was the kind of the worst shit sandwich I'd ever had, because it kind of started off, oh, you know, hope you're well. Well, I'm not well, am I? Because I've just found out my dad's died and no bastards told me. Except my mum's old school friend in passing. And then it started going on, you know, he referred to my dad in the third party rather than referring to him as my father or my dad or whatever. He referred to him by his first name. So it was almost like he was already making that assumption that I wasn't anything to do with him. We were separate entities. You know, and he said like, oh, you know, in the past he was very fond of you and talked about you very often. Right. Again, that's not kind of the typical kind of language you use between a parent and their child. It just, you know, I've since destroyed the letter because there was no point keeping it, was it, to be frank? It's not something I want to remember. And then it went on to, oh, however, in latter years, he was felt very let down by you. Now, one of my biggest triggers is disappointing people, particularly my family. That is probably the worst thing I could do, is the worst feeling in the world for me is disappointing my loved ones or my closest friends, who essentially are family. So to be told that I'd let him down was a real kick in the teeth. When he let me down so many times before. And it was, I didn't want a point score, and I didn't actually respond to that letter as much as I wanted to. And I still do in some ways. There are so many questions left unanswered. And I really struggle with that, because I don't want there to be any animosity. I'm not that kind of person. I don't like conflict, for one. I don't even like confronting people that have done me wrong. Though I really, really try to do that. Because I need to set an example to my son. That was a real, like I said, it was horrible to read that in a letter. And then it kind of ended up with something like, oh, well, he closed down his businesses. He sorted out his assets and it was able to sort out his personal affairs before he became too unwell. So that was the subtext for, if you've come looking for money, there isn't any. And in terms of certain personal affairs, where did I fit in that? Because clearly I wasn't worthy of that. His flesh and blood, his daughter, his only child. That I'm aware of. And so that was quite insulting. And then it ended up with a, hope you're well, if you need anything else, don't hesitate to contact me. Like it was like a business letter or something. And which turned out my uncle was his executor of his will. So it was quite a good kind of guess contacting him, really. But again, I wasn't, as much as I'm struggling with money now, money wasn't the thing. I don't want anything. I just want closure. That's all I wanted. I don't know how he died. I don't know if he was on his own. I don't know what he died from. Apologies, I had another coughing fit. But there were so many questions left unanswered for me that there is no possible way that I can move on and grieve and recover, because I've got no answers. He had the compassion to tell me where his ashes were going to be scattered. So that was something. He kind of sort of gave a half-hearted apology, or sorry that you weren't there, sort of thing. And I said, well, of course I was. So at the end of it, I can't use my uncle as target practice. That's unfair. He didn't live in the area anyway. He lived about 40, 50 miles away. And I only saw him a couple of times a year at best, when me and my dad were in sort of our relationship was good. And so I can't kind of appoint any blame. I could probably say that for the rest of his siblings and his extended family. Because they're just bystanders. At the end of the day, it's the relationship between me and him that was the crucial thing. And a big kind of part of me is thinking that it was his decision, that he didn't want me to be informed, that he didn't want me to be around in his final months and weeks and days, hours. his reasons, maybe only he knew. Those reasons may have died with him. You know, it could have come from, you know, when me and my mum discussed it, she said it might have been, he might have been giving you a bit of a mercy in that respect, that he didn't want you to see him in that state, that he didn't want you to have to deal with that. On the flip side, it could also have been that he disowned me completely. And I can live with that. I can live with the being, but there are bigger things, you know, there are bigger things in life, you know, that, and it wasn't that we'd fallen out. It was, we'd exchanged some words not long after little G was born. And that was mainly because he was in the wrong and I put him right. And the last time I saw him was when little G was about 6 months old. And that was the Christmas Eve after he was born. So that's, you know, looking at, you know, 2016 now. And we were okay. It was okay. It was different. But I told him a lot of stuff. I was open and honest from my perspective. I told him about the colitis, told him about I was struggling with my mental health and that I was getting support. And this is why I haven't been in touch as much. I've always been told communication is a two-way street. And it always seemed to be me doing the communicating. And I think when I kind of took a step back and prioritized my family unit, and those who wanted to be in my circle, so to speak, he took a bit of a back seat then, because I thought I can deal, he maybe naively, he's always going to be there and I can deal with him later on. And that sounds a bit crude, but that's basically the gist of it. And, you know, obviously then weeks turn into months, which turn into years, and the communication did ebb away. But if he had ever made contact, I would not have pushed away. I would have welcomed it in a way, but I may have been guarded about it. So maybe this is his cruel way of punishing me for not being in contact for so many years. Who knows? I may never know. And, you know, I have to kind of accept that I might not get the answers that I seek, but you know, and I don't know how I'm going to go about getting some answers. I, you know, was it something, you know, family history wise, do I need to know what caused his passing? Will it have an impact on, you know, from a hereditary point of view? Because when I have to discuss my family history, I'm not entirely sure, because I haven't got one of my parents to ask. And so there's little things, and I don't know whether it's just an anxiety thing or whether it's a me thing, but I like to know how things work, or I need to know the process of things. I need to know how things, that's just the way my brain works, whether it's a bit of you know, kind of a little quirk of mine, I don't know, but I like to know all the facts before I make decisions or do certain things. And this is why I probably struggle so much with this, and why I'm not able to kind of grieve in a way that helps me compartmentalize that and move on and lock it away and deal with it again. And obviously when I was planning the wedding and things like that, I was able to put a lid on it for the time being, because I thought, I'll deal with that after the wedding, because I've waited nearly 20 years to marry the love of my life, and I'm not letting the man that chose not to be in my life for the latter, you know, the last sort of almost 7 years to ruin that for me. And, you know, and this is probably a consequence of that. So I'm hoping that the counselling will be help. I doubt very much it'll be a hindrance, because I think talking to somebody impartial within the professional capacity to listen actively to issues can only be a positive experience. And it's probably going to be hard and awful, like it always is when I've had talking therapy in the past. But I'm hoping that it can be a tool to help me move on and maybe even help me with my confidence, which, like I said, is hit an all-time low. And I'm really, really struggling to kind of feel like me at the moment. So that's where things are at the moment. So things are kind of snowballed. I've got, you know, the car situation, the you know, the gynae situation, the, you know, everyday stresses and sort of dealing with that as well, the, you know, that kind of grief and, or, you know, struggling to be able to grieve. Things are going to catch up with you, aren't they? And I'm happy to say that the car situation is going to calm down a little bit. And, you know, I'm all for believing that the storm will pass. And I'll look back at this, hopefully, in a few months' time and think, wow, I'm glad I got through that. And I'm able to recognise that I'm not myself at the moment. So I need to be a bit kinder to myself, because what I tend to do is be my own worst critic and kind of kick myself when I'm down, which is completely counterproductive. And when I've had a look and sort of tried to figure out what it is, it might not be a specific thing that's causing this. It might just be, like I said, a snowball effect of a lot of other issues. I just worry that I'm dipping into depression again. Which I know I can come back from. I've fought back from it before and I can do it again. And I've probably got more support now than I've ever done. So I'm just aware of that. And that's hopefully going to help get me through this kind of rut at the moment. So I realise I've waffled on. I've probably coughed through most of it as well. I've waffled on for a while now. But just to reassure everybody, I am okay. I am all right. There's no, you know, I'm aware of what's going on. So, and I'm dealing with it accordingly. So I am accessing therapy and I'm going to speak to people. I'm going to, you know, find somebody to talk to, whether it's somebody in work or my mum or whoever. And, you know, little G and the dog are okay. they're my priorities at the moment. I'm all right. I'm muddling on and high functioning as always. I will be in touch, you know, as soon as I can. You know what I'm like. I'm not the most reliable when it comes to posting content in a regular kind of, in, you know, regular times. So I will keep you updated and, you know, I'll look out on my Instagram and other social media platforms, and I will be in touch and I'll keep everybody updated on what's going on. Like I said, you know, I'm very much one that, you know, I'm being open, honest and transparent with how I'm feeling and thinking at the moment. And I appreciate that people are out there probably feeling sort of similar feelings. So please keep talking. Please keep breaking that stigma. I do have a blog page, which is a bit like a website, which is wordpress.com/ulcerative colitis motherhood and me. There are some useful links under a tab on there. There's just some helplines, email addresses, and contact details for a few charities that I've myself used. But there are many out there. There are too many that I can list that will help anybody in a similar situation, or if you're going through any difficulties at the moment at all. I will update my blog at some point. So it's just, again, it's on my list of to-do things, but, you know, life keeps getting in the way. Please keep talking. Please don't suffer in silence. Keep that conversation flowing. You know, talk to whoever. Just take, you know, a problem shared is a problem halved. I'm very much, great believer in that mentality. There's a lot of stuff going on at the moment, current affairs and things that can be very upsetting to anyone, and that might be a trigger for some people. So please keep talking. you know, make have those conversations, and it does help relieve some of that pain and anxiety that you're feeling. So I'm going to go now, guys. I will keep you updated. I promise I'm okay, and I'll get over this cough as well. Lots of love to you all. Stay safe. Take care. Speak soon. Good night.